Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available real-time traffic alerts. More at acura.com/RDX.
This podcast is a production of KCRW.com.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, and prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, while Jack Sparrow and his unsavory crew were raking in the doubloons at the box office, pirates of a different kind were plundering Hollywood's treasure chest. We'll look into the very big business of counterfeit DVD. Then, we go from pirating movies to hijacking ideas. How do you protect your hot movie idea from copycats? But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Accept no imitations. It's The Business from NPR. While talent is fighting for online residuals, certain high-ranking executives, including the chief executive of Warner Brothers, are calling for an end to residuals altogether. The claim is that breaking down residuals by medium, TV, home video, internet, etc., just doesn't make sense anymore. We claim this is just a bargaining tactic for upcoming contract negotiations. Elsewhere, if you went to see Paramount's new CGI epic Transformers last week, you might have been confused by what looked like a home video clip of a Bon Voyage soiree that played before the film. Suddenly, explosions, screams, mass confusion. The ostensibly amateur footage is in fact a trailer by Lost creator J.J. Abrams for an untitled new film called, well, we don't know, but it's due out in theaters in January. What's really brilliant is that the trailer then popped up on YouTube, courtesy of camcording pirates, and I'm using the air quotes there. Paramount then feigned horror and insisted that the trailer be taken down. The result has been exactly what the studio must have been hoping for. Thousands may have seen the trailer in theaters, but millions saw it online. On the flip side, publicity surrounding the new torture porn thriller Captivity continues to be disastrous. In May, Lionsgate was forced to push the opening to July because of widespread outrage over its lurid bind, torture, terminate billboards. But that was nothing compared to the scene at the party after the film's Hollywood premiere. According to my old friend Paul Cullum at the LA Times, the reception at the Sunset Strip nightclub Privilege featured two women in chains and dog collars kissing and writhing on a revolving tabletop. A man hoisted into the air by his numerous piercings inside a wire mesh cage, and a professional dominatrix using a large hairbrush to strike a nearly naked man chained to the floor, quote, each blow to his buttocks carrying enough force to echo loudly over the sound system, end quote. At one point, the toilets at the club overflowed. A metaphor for the film and its makers? You be the judge. Finally, are you ready for Crazy Eddie, the movie? Yes, the New York Post reported last week that Danny DeVito's Jersey Films is eagerly trying to obtain the rights to the life and times of home electronics peddler Crazy Eddie Antar. With his ubiquitous TV ads, Crazy Eddie turned a single discount electronics store in Brooklyn into a Northeast retail empire. Alas, Antar was convicted of stock fraud after taking the company public in 1987. Surprisingly, the not guilty by reason of insanity defense didn't work for the man who always claimed his prices were insane. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up later in the show, I could tell you about my great movie idea. But first, I'll need you each to sign a non-disclosure agreement. Coming up next, movie pirates, get ready to walk the plank. Over the extended July 4th weekend, five people were arrested in New York, California, Florida, Georgia, and Illinois for illegally camcording the new action flick Transformers. What's unusual is not the camcording, but the arrests. Because this kind of thieving goes on every day, everywhere. While internet piracy gets a lot more press, a whopping $11 billion of the estimated $18 billion that the studios claim is lost to piracy each year is the result of so-called physical piracy, including the bootlegged DVDs peddled on streets all over the world. Of course, the way the piracy figures are compiled makes a lot of assumptions. Truth be told, lots of people who buy fake DVDs probably were never going to pay to see the film anyway. And it could be argued that people who pay full price for a lousy movie are more likely to badmouth it. And you could further extrapolate that someone who's seen a bad copy of a good movie might just go and pay to see it at the mall anyway. Having said that, we can all agree that piracy is big business. But where do these pirated movies come from? What do they look like? And who buys them? We sent producer Darby Maloney on a voyage in search of pirates.
Arr.
Skyscrapers tower over the intersection of Broadway and 6th, but this part of downtown L.A. feels like a city in Central America. Neon signs in Spanish advertise gold chains by the ounce, and street vendors sell everything from baby clothes to corn on the cob with chili and mayonnaise. You don't have to look too far for pirated DVDs. They're laid out on the sidewalk and hawked from backpacks pretty much everywhere. I found one vendor walking around with a black plastic bag full of Hollywood's latest titles.
What's selling the most? What's the most popular right now?
Right now, the Transformers. And then Shrek the Third, Spider-Man, Ocean 13, the Surf Up, and everything. Mostly everything is selling now, but Transformers selling like right now a lot.
Now keep in mind that almost all the movies in this bag are in theaters now. They are not available on DVD, and a lot of them showed up on the street the day they opened. These movies won't be in stores for a while. And if they were available, they'd be a lot more expensive. Here on the street, it's $5 each or 5 for 20. Or I could also buy 50 for $2 a piece and get my own business going if I was so inclined.
Yours are good quality.
They're good quality.
No,
they're not the theater, no people walking around, nothing. They're good quality. They're 100%.
I grabbed Knocked Up, Spider-Man 3, and the new Pixar hit, Ratatouille. And I ask her where she gets them.
I don't know who makes them or nothing. I don't know, you know. And I don't want to say who's the people sending to me, you know. Because I don't want to get in trouble or get myself killed or nothing.
My $15 deal may seem trifling, but making pirated DVDs is a major criminal enterprise. Some films are ripped off by petty thieves, most by sophisticated crime rings here and around the world. So what kind of person puts money in the hands of these criminals?
People like old people, like black people, white people, Mexican, like Hispanic, anybody, Chinese people will buy you the movies no matter what.
And today, people like me. Okay, let's start with Knocked Up. The cover looks legit. Seth Rogen on the cover, Judd Apatow. The DVD has no label, so looks blank. All right, we'll put it in. It smells nasty, like burnt plastic or something. I'm actually psyched to see this movie because I've seen this, so I can compare whether it's Charlotte's Web. What the hell? I popped Ratatouille in the DVD player.
Ratatouille? It's a peasant dish.
I think this must have been shot in a theater because it's slightly out of focus, it's tilted, and there's laughing and coughing, and I think I just saw a finger go in front of the lens. The quality of pirated DVDs goes from pretty darn good to totally unwatchable. I watched the bootleg copy of Spider-Man 3 with Henry Klein, who was the cameraman.
It has no resemblance to the way the film looks in the movie theater or the intent of the producers and the director and the cameraman. You know, here they are lying on the web at night, and you know, we spend hours of our day making it so the audience can see everything, so you can see the texture on the ground behind them, so you can, you know, light the web that they're lying on separately, and then making sure that there's beautiful light in them, because those are our movie stars and we want them to look great.
In another scene, Peter Parker's grandmother gets some milk.
She opens the refrigerator door and it looks like nuclear dawn inside there.
Henry figures this DVD may have been pirated somewhere along the post-production process, or maybe a projectionist copied it. But that's unlikely these days, since the film reels are typically only unlocked just before a screening. Most of the DVDs on the street come from camcording in theaters. Mike Robinson is director of anti-piracy operations for the MPAA. He heads a team of undercover investigators that track movie pirates.
They'll go in and be very sophisticated. The professionals will. They'll use clamps or tripods and affix them to the arm of the chair. And on some occasions may even use the sound from that system that's intended for the hearing impaired and marry that with the recording as well.
The lengths these pirates will go to and the technology they use can be impressive, even if the result isn't always. Pinhole cameras stuck in popcorn tubs and cameras that can beam the movie wirelessly to recorders elsewhere in the theater are not unheard of. Now, theater owners are trying equally clever countermeasures in the war on piracy.
People have made use of night vision goggles to get clear vision of the camcorder standing out from everything else in the background.
Patrick Corcoran is Director of Media and Research for the National Association of Theater Owners, also known as NATO.
You know, there are some basic things. I mean, if it's, you know, a hot day and somebody's wearing a long coat, you know, you may want to keep an eye out because they may have their equipment and their tripod and everything else stashed under the coat.
The MPAA and NATO are giving theater employees up to $500 apiece for reporting camcorder theft to the cops. There have been 84 bounties collected so far, many around the May release of Spider-Man 3.
There were about 30 camcording attempts that were interrupted and about 15 people were arrested. There was one example where somebody said that he was recording it for his daughter's birthday party. And there was one where the mother was holding the camera when they were leaving the theater. It's fairly brazen.
Once you've got a copy, it's easy to become an entry-level pirate. You can buy DVD burning towers at any electronics store. Of course, the industry is more focused on the big guys. The feds confiscated more than 100,000 DVDs in the largest bust in the U.S. Overseas, where enforcement is more lax, it's 10 times that. In the States, someone caught with 100 or more DVDs faces a felony charge, and that felony could get you 3 years in state prison. But the financial rewards seem to outweigh the risks.
An average DVD, including the cover, the cellophane wrap, the artwork, and the DVD art inside a pirated DVD, only costs 46 cents to manufacture one. 46 cents.
Rick Ishitani is one of six full-time detectives in the LAPD Anti-Piracy Unit.
You take that and compare it to drugs, $5 rock cocaine, let's say, for example. It takes about a dollar, anywhere from a dollar to $1.50 to manufacture one $5 rock cocaine. And these guys out here are selling these DVDs for $5. So the profit margin is a lot more selling these illegal pirated DVDs than selling drugs.
In an eight-hour day, the vendor I met says she sells between $700 and $800 worth of DVDs and takes home $230 of that. The rest goes to the next guy up the ladder.
An average DVD manufacturer makes anywhere from $15,000. We've seen up to $40,000 a month cash.
On the supply side, the movie industry is constantly lobbying for tougher anti-piracy laws, both here and abroad. They're working on new technology, and they've even trained two DVD-sniffing dogs named Lucky and Flo. And to reduce demand, studios are considering closing the window between theater and home video release. Meanwhile, theater owners are talking about, quote, improving the movie-going experience. But in the end, it comes down to simple economics.
A family of four will spend approximately $50 to $60 to watch a movie, including popcorn and a Coke. Now, you go down to downtown, you pay $5 for the same movie that's playing right now in a movie theater. You pop it in your DVD player in the comfort of your own home. It might not be the best quality, but you still get the idea of the movie.
Even cameraman Henry Klein can understand why people buy pirated DVDs.
You know, I wouldn't want to own this as my copy of Spider-Man 3, but I could totally see somebody watching this movie and feeling like they'd actually seen the movie, even though, you know, I should be turning over my grave just by saying it.
Patrick Corcoran from the National Organization of Theater Owners recognizes that piracy will never completely go away.
At a certain level, if somebody's giving something away, especially something that doesn't belong to them, you can't compete with that. You can't compete with free.
For The Business, I'm Darby Maloney.
You can see pictures of real live DVD pirate dens at kcrw.com/thebusiness. In 1970, the Marshall University football team gained fame for beating the odds after many of its players died in a plane crash. Last week, the makers of a documentary film about that famous team sued Warner Brothers over their feature film, We Are Marshall, claiming fraud, copyright infringement, and breach of contract. In other words, they're saying the studio stole their idea. With no comment implied about the merits of the suit, the fact of the matter is that if you know someone who works in Hollywood, you probably know someone who'll claim they've been robbed of a brilliant idea. Maybe they have, and maybe they haven't. On one hand, it's tough to protect ideas in a business where there are no secrets. On the other hand, even the Greeks knew that humans have only a handful of stories to tell. So, How do you keep your blockbuster from being ripped off? The business producer Matt Holzman called up attorney Pierce O'Donnell to ask. Amongst numerous other plagiarism cases, O'Donnell successfully represented humorist Art Buchwald in his high-profile 1990 suit against Paramount Pictures.
Pierce O'Donnell, welcome to the business.
Great to be here, Matt.
Well, let's start with the basic question. How do you protect an idea in Hollywood?
You can't protect an idea in Hollywood or anywhere else in the globe.
Yeah, expand on that.
I will. The copyright law of the United States is very clear and has been for over a century that a mere idea, boy meets girl, they fall in love, and they live happily ever after, that's an idea, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And merely as I expressed it, just those words, that is an unprotectable idea, okay?
Okay.
We can move on, and we can now give each character a personality, give them a backstory. We can give them a context. We can give them dialogue. Now, the expression of what I just described and how it twists and turns in the plot and how the characters evolve and meet crisis and resolve, that would be protectable.
All right, but given that, what are some of the practical ways that you might protect an idea?
I think there's two. One is write it down, date it, mail it to yourself, and register it with the Screenwriters Guild East or West, if it's related to motion picture or television.
Now, there is a kind of a fallacy that by registering it, it is then protected. But what that does is give you something to go to court with later if you need to.
It's registration of title, okay? That's all it is.
And it says this was written on this date, and that's about...
Yeah, and they actually file stamp it. They put it away in a confidential file, and you have a receipt.
Okay.
The mailing of it also is some indicia of when you created it, okay?
Okay.
Maybe your computer file might be some indication, although people can mess with those things.
Right.
But let's say you are an experienced screenwriter and you have an agent and a relationship with Warner Brothers, let's say, okay? And your agent would call him and say, look, Matt wants to come in tomorrow and pitch you a story. Do you have anything in development about X subject? Well, we do. Well, then I'm not sure that we can talk to you. And then there's kind of a kabuki dance, if you will, about how much do you want to disclose and not disclose. But it's a very murky area. It's a very tricky area. And whether or not you disclose something that they then use is a very fact-driven issue if you ever have to go to court.
And there is a practice that I think is kind of new, which basically when you walk on the lot to pitch something, you fill out a form that says, I realize that there are other projects floating around this studio. There might be one similar to mine, and trying to kind of indemnify the studio to some degree.
A classic example of something that would never be protected is mere history. Okay, if you go in and pitch, I'm going to tell the Gettysburg story. Man, that's free as the air. Belongs to everybody, okay?
Mm-hmm.
However, you write a 120-page screenplay with characters, fictionalized characters, and you use Gettysburg as the backdrop, that would be protected if somebody actually copied it and using substantial expression of yours in your Gettysburg play.
That's playing out right now a bit with the court case about the film We Are Marshall.
You got it.
Okay, so it's a factual series of events, but the way it was portrayed is an expression of that particular piece of history. So there's maybe some uncertainty there about who's right and who's wrong.
I had a client who wrote a very unique piece in a major magazine about a Glendale doctor who was in cahoots with bad guys, and he actually killed people in his office, and they cashed in the insurance. And a writer for a major newspaper came to her and tried to buy her research. She said no, so he basically went out and copied her articles into a book. But he made a mistake. He copied some of the errors. She had some factual historical errors, and that's how we caught him.
We'll be right back with attorney Pierce O'Donnell about the nearly impossible task of protecting ideas in Hollywood. You're listening to The Business from NPR. You're listening to The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. What do the movies Amistad, Rounders, Kingdom of Heaven, The Matrix, The Last Samurai, and Honey, I Blew Up the Kids have in common? Well, in each case, someone claimed that the studios ripped them off. With Amistad, author Barbara Chase Raboud claimed that DreamWorks had lifted parts of her 1989 book, Echo of Lions. In court, attorney Pierce O'Donnell reportedly called Amistad credited screenwriter David Franzoni, quote, a rank plagiarist, unquote. It's hard to know the truth. That suit was later dropped. So, how do you keep your blockbuster from being ripped off? The business producer Matt Holzman called up attorney Pierce O'Donnell to ask.
The studios, it is much more in their interest really just to option a script than to steal it from anybody.
It's cheaper.
It's much cheaper that way. And that
you have to pay an expensive lawyer like me to defend you.
Right, exactly. So that, in fact, the place where you're more likely to be stolen from are by other writers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Producers.
Or, yes.
But the difference is
or
that—
Or agents for well-known writers who've gone dry.
Right.
I've seen that, too. If you and I are sitting at the Melrose Cafe, I like to use this example when I teach, and we start kicking around an idea for a movie, and a guy next to us overhears us and tape records it, and he goes out and writes that story, okay? We probably don't have a lot of recourse unless we got really down and detailed about the character, the context, the setting, what the challenge was going to be to the main character, who's the antagonist, da-da-da-da-da. You understand what I'm saying?
I do. Now, let's talk about what was, I think, a bit of a change in law a few years ago that had to do with implied contracts.
Yes.
Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah. For a long time, until a famous case in 1956, which has since been evolved since then, called Desney versus Wilder, it used to be that unless you had a written agreement that somebody was going to buy your idea, even though it might not be copyright protectable, you had to have a written agreement that they were going to use your idea and they would pay you a certain amount. In the Desney case, a guy named Desney called up Billy Wilder, the famous director who happened to be at Paramount, and pitched the story to his secretary about a historical event and how it could be made into a movie.
Pitched the story to Wilder's secretary.
To his secretary,
okay.
His assistant. It was about the Collins Mine disaster, as I recall. It had been a historical event. He said, Mr. Wilder could make a great movie out of this. And she said, well, I'm sure if he uses it, he'll pay you. A year later, the movie came out, okay? And it was what the guy had pitched. And so he sued, and he got thrown out in the lower courts. But the California Supreme Court, in a landmark case, which I mentioned, Desney versus Wilder, said, hold it. You can have a written express contract saying we'll pay you if we use your idea, even though the idea may not be copyright protectable because it's not fully expressed. But to protect people, creative people, we're going to impose an implied contract. The law implies the promise that, in fact, the secretary made that, look, if we use your material, we'll pay you fair market value.
Which is why some studios may be even reticent to hear a pitch from somebody, because it then puts them in an implied contract.
Absolutely. In fact, I can tell you right now, unless you're represented by a well-regarded agent or a well-known entertainment lawyer, your script gets returned unopened. The studios receive probably hundreds or thousands of scripts a year, and they have a routine legal practice which is enforced, strictly enforced, that if we don't know where this thing came from and who's vouching for it, we send it back.
There was a case involving Amistad, and you represented the plaintiff in that case, who wrote a book about the famous slaving ship and sued Steven Spielberg and his company about the movie they made about it. If someone had taken that story and made it into a musical or made it into a comedy, would that have been demonstrably different from the book, which was a serious historical account of what happened?
The reason she had a good case is she created a fictional character who became Morgan Freeman,
in the movie,
the independent publisher, the printer of The Liberator, whatever.
Right.
And that character did not exist in history. And that was a unique character that she created that they borrowed. Okay?
But what if they did a comedy in which that character was involved?
She might also still have an action because she created the character.
I see.
If it was an historical character, like obviously John Adams was a real figure, she can't get protection on John Adams if he starts dancing on Broadway, which I think he does in 1776.
He does indeed.
Okay. But she created a unique character, and it might very well, that protection might very well carry into another form other than cinema.
But if you took a historical character and gave him an attribute that somebody had not given him before, let's say I wrote a book, and in the book I write that John Adams can fly, and then somebody makes a movie in which John Adams could fly, John Adams is still a historical character. I mean, obviously you're not a judge, and this is not something—
No, it's a hypothetical. Go ahead, like it.
But, you know, do you think that would—
That's a close one. I think you might have to— tell us how he flies and why he flies and where did he get his wings and does he fly to avenge injustice at night and returns to his little Braintree home office and farm daytime and what's Dolly doing? Did she make the cape for him or does she know about it? I mean, I'm getting silly, but I'm trying to make the point.
Right. It's in the devil's in the details.
It's very much in the details and the more concrete. Now, oftentimes when I'm the plaintiff, the defendant studio will say, oh, that's a sent-off fare. People fly all the time. I say, really? How many second presidents of the United States do you know they've ever flown? And so it's contextual, as you just said. It's kind of fact-driven.
Right.
And, you know, it unfortunately, and again, I go back to the protecting your rights, all these prophylactics, these practical things you can do are very, very helpful. But if you have to go to law court, just like getting an agent sort of the first cut, whether you're going to make it as a writer or not, if you can get a lawyer to believe in your cause and she's willing to invest maybe $1 million worth of time and some costs for experts and transcripts and whatever else, that's the other problem. And while we won the Buchwald case and we got Mr. Buchwald and Alan Bernheim as producer partner $1 million, I spent over $4 million of lawyer time doing it, and Paramount spent even more than that defending it. Now, the typical lawyer who was a nuts like I guess I was wouldn't do it. And one of the byproducts of that case was fewer and fewer lawyers in Hollywood take on plaintiff's cases against well-heeled studios.
When you're deciding to take a case, does how well the movie did play into your decision whether to accept it or not?
Yeah, I think it's almost equal with what I think the merits of the case are. I have to tell you, I've turned down a number of cases for writers, even experienced writers, where I just said, you know, the economics don't work for me, and therefore they don't work for you.
Hmm.
The movie hadn't been that big a success.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, it really is. And it goes back to the unlevel playing field, Matt, that we talked about earlier in this conversation. It's just the way it is, and it's a reality. There's so many talented writers who I've met over the 30 years I've been in Los Angeles who just, you know, like actors and actresses, it's tough to get a break. And then the tragedy is I've had this case where a young writer did write something very significant and it was stolen.
And?
I couldn't take his case because he might get a $250,000 writing fee and he would have gotten 5% of the net, which is worthless.
Pierce O'Donnell is the founder of the Los Angeles trial and litigation law firm of O'Donnell & Associates. Pierce, thank you for spending your time on The Business.
Great, Matt. Love talking to you, buddy.
Your fee, how much do I owe you?
See, about $600.
All right, just send me the bill.
But you know something? I'm going to give you the pro bono discount.
And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney, and a fine one she is. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts covering politics, news, music, arts, and culture. For more details, visit kcrw.com.